I'm just here knowing enough to be dangerous.
Welcome, everybody, to Nashville Drummers Podcast, episode 43.
Hope everyone has been staying warm this month. We're super stoked to welcome Lemmy Will Hayes, to the podcast. Most of you guys probably know him from going into Nelson's Drum Shop. He is the current shop manager. And man, Lemuel has quite a breadth of music industry experience. It was great just letting him talk to us and just share his stories with us. The takeaway for me was just all the setbacks he's been through. Both we talk about some physical injury that he's had to overcome, also mental health and sobriety, some big topics, some heavy topics that he's handled with just such grace and
poise.
Thank you.
Yeah, there we go. And as you listen, pay attention for the phrase, knowing enough to be dangerous. It is an important one that comes up. We hope you enjoy this episode of the Nashville Drummers Podcast. After much ado, much traffic nonsense, double accident, and I think a Titans game.
Yeah, note to self, let's not schedule a podcast during the Titans game. During a Titans game commute.
Really anything during a Titans game. It sort of cripples the city.
It does.
Yeah. Are you into sports? Do you partake?
I don't dislike it. I just find that I have so many other things that I need to do that I don't, it's not a priority.
Hmm.
You know, if I'm on the road somewhere and we have an off day and there's Thursday night football or something, you know, I'll watch it with, if the rest of the band's watching it. And I know enough to be dangerous about pretty much everything except, I guess maybe at this point I know enough about soccer. I could be dangerous.
I like that line. I know enough to be dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? But I don't. I am definitely not currently one of the guys, this act that I've been out with, the steel player and the artist. I mean, they're to the point that they'll do a little bit of sports betting.
Mm.
Oh, I don't even, and that now I don't know any of that terminology. So I'm just like, yeah, okay, cool. Yeah, man.
Yeah, just listen.
I don't know what a parlay is.
Yeah.
Unless it's from Pirates of the Caribbean.
Right.
That's the only time I've heard the word.
That's what I was going to say. Like, I know. Wait, isn't that?
I thought that was like a trade. I guess I'm wrong. A trade for Keira Knightley. It's what I heard. That's all I know about it.
Well, I had a friend some years back who told me that if I really wanted to get into sports, because I was just like, I just don't care. He was like, well, if you want to get into it, start betting on it. You'll get into it real quick. I'm like, I don't know that that's how I want to, you know, my life at all. Well, I'm not into that. Well, I better put some money on it. Then I'll probably be into it.
Then I gotta care.
Yeah, I'm like, that's true, but that's also just such nonsense, abject craziness.
Yeah. I mean, I've had friends that did the fantasy thing, and I think that made them really good at it. Are really into it because you just got to know so much of the stats. Even when I was a kid, I was really into baseball, loved baseball. And even then, I don't think that I was a stats guy. Granted, I was also a kid. Kids don't give a shit about numbers.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, they're like, oh yeah, you know, he's this and this for the season with this many interceptions. I mean, and it changes. They keep it up to date, which just sounds exhausting.
Yeah.
To me, I have enough shit to remember.
And then you're like,
drum parts.
Yeah.
You start talking about who now just was fired from which gig, and now who picked, like, oh, and then everyone else is looking at you like, oh yeah? Yeah, is it boring what we're talking about? Yeah. Okay.
Can we do music industry betting? Can we start that?
Whoa. I love it. Yeah, fantasy, like,
that's going in the notes.
Your roster of fantasy
right
players.
Now.
You have, you know, drummer, guitar, bassist, vocalist.
Oh yeah, dude, what's your fantasy band's stats this week?
This is...
That's hilarious, yeah.
Listen,
I got 10 under on the double shift for Nico or something.
Oh, man. Oh, he had a stick drop. A stick drop on Sunday. It was hard to see.
Awesome.
My stats went down.
Exactly,
telling you right now, whether this is a real thing or not ever, we are turning this into a skit.
That's
100%.
I love it, yeah.
That's
we're going to have you back, and we're going to do this.
All right.
That's fine. This is going well already.
It's going really great. Well, let me set the scene before we jump into too many things here. We're here with Lemmy Hayes, Lemuel.
What's
right?
up? Yeah, yeah.
I think most people here in town probably have seen you over at Nelson's.
It's possible.
Or out on the road or in town on different gigs.
Man but, about town.
Yeah, we're stoked to have you here. How long have you been in Nashville?
10 years.
10 years. Mm-hmm. 10 year mm-hmm. town, huh? Is that what they say?
That's what they say. You know, yeah. It is.
What do you think about that?
Well, I think that I also moved here when I was, you know, actually older, but maybe not like intellectually older than most people. I also had some sidetracks in there, but I think it could be that. Definitely. I mean, I feel pretty good about where I am, but I definitely wish that I was a little bit further along, but you don't really have any control over it to a large degree. And I lost a good, my first year was like a pretty much a wash. Because I got this bad little boy happened. Yeah. I had been here about 10 or 11 months when that happened. And
what happened there?
I was running and fell and broke my right humerus. Ooh. And there's a plate in it. And when you break either of your humeri, they put a plate in it and they have to move one of the two main nerves to get it because they both run through the elbow.
Yeah.
And the plate covers the elbow. So when they move it, whichever one they move, neither of it, like whichever one, nothing from the elbow down works and it has to repair itself. So like the ulnar nerve is on the bottom and the radial nerve's on the top. So they moved my radial nerve. So I could squeeze because that's everything down here.
Right.
But this was how my wrist was. So I wore a brace so that my muscles didn't think this was the new position.
Yeah.
Wow.
And, but I couldn't do anything. So like if you just relax your wrist and push up in the center of your palm, that's what my hand was like for 6 months.
Wow.
So that's your first year moving here.
Yeah. Yeah. I hadn't even been here a year
yet. Dude, that's like a nightmare injury.
It was
a drummer,
suboptimal.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
So I had like a goofy setup that I tried to will myself to practice on at home. That was like rack tom, snare drum, kick drum all in the same place, but then everything else to the left side. And I was just trying to play everything with one hand.
Yeah.
Just, which was also my non-dominant hand. So I wasn't very good, but it makes you appreciate a lot of things and you just end up listening. I found that I listened to music and I definitely was a different player on the other side of it for a lot of reasons. I mean, obviously you have to regain the muscle and the dexterity and all that stuff. And also, I had 6 months of doing nothing but listening to music and not being able to play it. So it's just all analysis.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like watching the tapes.
Yeah. I mean, that's good on you for having that mindset. It probably would have been just as easy to just be like, well, woe is me and this sucks. And
I mean, I did plenty of that.
Yeah.
There's like, I was working seasonal at Guitar Center prior to that. And then, then I had nothing to do. So then I stayed there. Which was fine. And I was, the guy that hired me there was Jared. He was the guitar manager. I'm very grateful. He was kind and everybody there was super kind. And, throughout that whole thing. And, I was definitely doing some stuff that you shouldn't do with a broken arm, like climbing ladders, because this is before they remodeled the Hundred Oaks Guitar Center. So I kept all the hardware in the drum department above. If you were looking at the counter, there was like a soffit that had a design and shit or whatever on it. And all the hardware was behind it. So you had to get up on a ladder and pull it down.
Oof.
So I just drop it on the floor.
Oh my gosh.
Got pretty good at dropping it flat. So the box landed flat.
Nice.
New skill sets acquired.
Baby skills. Yeah. But honestly, the number one thing that I remember about that time more than anything is I remember three people. So everybody, it was clear that something was wrong with me. That's where I met Hubert Payne. And he was so gracious. He has so much of that motivational personality to begin with. But, he has a pretty gnarly injury in his past from this whole thing. I don't want to tell his story and what he does and what doesn't want. But he has a pretty bad injury. He had a pretty bad injury to his left hand.
Yeah, I'm only loosely familiar with him and his journey.
Yeah, and he really kind of talked me through his just part of it and the mental part. And it was really helpful just to have that kind of energy being projected.
I'm sure, especially as a fellow drummer.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And to see that, okay, he made it through this and he's succeeding. And because he had just, like right before he got the little big town thing when Seth went on to something else. And Then Eddie Bayers, I met him briefly and we had a conversation because he has also has like a different hand injury. And Chris Terrell randomly bought some cymbals from me on Reverb. You know, he didn't know. And then the next day he came in and I had them because I had messaged him and didn't know who it was. And I just said, hey, man, I live not far from where your address is. I'm happy to just like drop these off. He's like, nah, man, just ship them. I'm going to be out of town. And then he came into Guitar Center the next day. And I was like, did you buy some cymbals on Reverb? And he was like, yeah, man. And he refused to let me refund him the shipping. He just took them with him because I had them, which is a cool, it's a tiny thing. But then every time he'd come in after that, he'd always see ask how I was doing.
Yeah.
And it's just a, that I think that a lot of that is what is very good about the Nashville community at large, not necessarily just drums. I do think the drums in a general sense have a much more of a community.
Totally. That's why we're here.
Yeah. Then maybe some other instruments. I do think that there's probably more of a community for those other instruments in Nashville specifically than in some other towns. But drums have always, I think, had their own thing. Even even back like in Georgia where I'm from, it's the same same deal. So
have you spent time in other music cities or was it just Georgia?
I mean, I just
Nashville?
Have tons of friends in like LA and New York and have talked about it. And a number of friends that even who relocated during the pandemic or whatever from LA or New York to here. And they've said, yeah, we had a thing. I mean, it's definitely more of a hang here with drummers. But I had some buddies that had kind of a burger and bourbon drummer club that did their thing in New York. And I think actually half of those guys have moved here, which is funny. So,
that's so cool.
I mean, it's closer to bourbon. So I guess if that's your world.
That's true.
You could have a day trip and go up there.
That's, a burger and bourbon day trip drummer club.
That's right.
Whoa. That's a mouthful. Quite literally.
Like bourbons and burgers.
Mm-hmm. That's, well, I mean, it makes sense. I totally agree. I do think that Nashville has kind of a little bit more of a specialness for that in particular. I do, I mean, I'm the same as you. I've got lots of friends in LA and New York, and I'm like, I know from talking to those guys that they're not really like hanging all the time. Like, yeah, I'm gigging. Like, that's cool.
Yeah.
But do you have community with other guys? I'm like, you just know that they're there. Oh yeah, I'm really glad. Yeah. You know, I got to go out and see so and so playing. That's great. Mm-hmm. Then there's nothing wrong with that. And I want to do that. Love to go and support the show. But
yeah,
city size I think impacts it a lot as well.
Absolutely,
I mean, you can
does.
Drive side to side of this city at the widest point in 40 minutes.
See, I love that.
Yep.
You know? I mean, that ain't gonna get you anywhere in LA.
No. Yeah. As long as there's not two car accidents and a Titans game, you'll be fine.
Yeah.
Yep. And it's not a Tuesday at 2 p.m. or something, and it's not raining. It has to be just right.
Yeah.
It's a lot of factors.
But when conditions are optimum, damn it, you can get across the city quick.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
So I do think that that's a large part of it to a degree. I mean, and the New York thing is, it's New York. It's great and awful at the same time.
Exactly.
It's the dirtiest and coolest place I've ever been.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not the dirtiest place I've been, but it is cool. It is the best
second
ratio
to
dirty.
Broadway. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Actually, Philly was dirtier.
Philly?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't doubt that.
Yeah.
Is Philly the dirtiest place you've ever been?
The part of Philly I was in was, man.
This isn't metaphorical, like dirty.
Yeah, exactly.
It's dirty. It was maybe not the dirtiest, but it was the dirtiest.
It was filthy. Yeah.
I keep having this conversation. One of my singers is from Baltimore. He's like, Baltimore's way worse. So like, where I was in Baltimore was nice. Where I was in Philly,
I thought for sure I was gonna die.
Yeah. it was great. Like bagel shops and shit. Like it was like, this is not what I heard Baltimore was like. Like, yeah, if you go like three streets down, you're gonna die. I'm like, okay, cool. Well,
yeah,
I won't go
there. I mean, I've had some weird experiences in Baltimore. Obviously, I'm fine, and I've been very lucky to never get mugged or anything like that there. But it's hard.
Yeah.
It's not to be flexed with.
No.
Yeah. You got to watch out for yourself.
Oh, for sure.
I want to take a quick aside to ask a really important burning question before we move on to other drum-related topics. Who is Franck and why is Franck?
Franck
forever?
Is my dog.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say that sure is.
His name is technically awesome. Frank, but I call him Franck.
Franck is forever.
You know, it's a dog, and you got to have nicknames.
What does it say? None of your business?
Oh, yeah. I bought this hat that I just had breakfast with two of my friends, and one of them had this hat that said, "Don't ask me for shit." It just had the number 4. And it it was this huge, thick embroidered hat that it looked exactly like something you'd buy at a gas station, like on the western side of Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like if you've stopped at one of those gas stations, you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
And it has like the Croco, like iridescent bill. And then it also had "Don't ask me for shit" on the bill. So then we were looking at, I was trying to find it. And then I found this one that says "None of your business" in this huge block font, thick embroidery. And I was like, I got to do it. So then I put it on him and he actually like let the hat stay on him.
Yeah. He looks very calm.
Yeah. He's a chill boy, but, yeah, he had a pretty gnarly like health scare earlier this year. And I then was in a van for way too long driving to Montana. And I got a Instagram ad that was like, "Turn your dog into a whatever." I don't remember what it
you were
and
targeted.
I was like,
yeah.
Spaceship.
I was like, done. We're doing this.
Yeah.
The dog in the ad, I remember his name was Tater Tot, which I was like, I kind of wish that he had a stupid name like that right
now. Yeah.
But he's a great boy. But,
is he good now? Is he doing all right?
Yeah. He it was a pretty scary week.
Okay. Gotcha.
He's like randomly stopped eating. There was no lead up. It was just like, stop eating, stop drinking.
Whoa.
Mm.
And then he spent like a week, literally a week. I'd get up really early, take him to the vet as soon as they open.
Yeah.
He'd be there all day getting IVs and fluids while they tried to figure it out. Jeez. And we did that for a week. And then we had to feed him with it's effectively dog Ensure, the drink. And I had to feed him that with a syringe the next week.
Yeah.
It was a trying time.
Did it just ride itself?
It eventually did, yeah. Basically, they think that he had an ulcer just inside the small intestine from the stomach, and it was causing a lot of inflammation, but it didn't cause anything to leak. It was like painful to pass anything.
Yeah. Gotcha.
But as we could get the liquid in him, that would provide him all the nutrients and also obviously liquid, like hydration. And then it just like sort of, it took a while. And then he had a prescription dog food that had high probiotics to rebuild his gut bacteria and high fiber so that nothing stayed.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And he just now actually got off that.
That's great to hear. I'm glad he's doing all right.
And yeah.
I'm more glad you are wearing that shirt.
Oh, yeah.
Please tell me you were planning that for like 2 weeks. Like, I'm wearing this on the podcast.
I had the thought a couple days ago. I was like, what should I wear for this? And then I was like, you know what?
Frog is forever.
I got it.
Frog is forever.
I got it.
It's a beautiful shirt. For those of you not watching, you're missing out.
Yeah.
I know most of you.
Well, now this will be in all of the social media clips, front and center.
Frank is immortalized.
He's
now, if our content goes viral, you can thank Frank.
Sick.
It's probably nothing to do with you, but it's going
to
be the shirt.
It definitely won't be anything to do with me. It'll be him being super cute.
Today, we're welcoming a new sponsor to the podcast, Lowboy Custom Beaters. These guys make the absolute best sounding, best feeling, and best looking bass drum beaters in the game.
Yeah, I bought my first Lowboy in 2016. It was a red and blue with white stripes, and I was able to design it and buy it right on their website, and Lowboy has been my go-to beater ever since. This thing feels and sounds great on any gig, and they just look even better.
One thing I really love about Lowboy is that you can customize the tone of your beater in addition to the look. Go with a wood striking surface for maximum attack, leather for a warm punch, felt if you want it a bit boomier, or lamb's wool for those felt but not heard kick drum tones. You can buy Lowboy beaters here in Nashville at Forks, Drum Supply, and Nelson Drum Shop. You can also demo all 8 beater models at Drumbox. Check them out at lowboybeaters.com.
So let's jump into your journey.
Okay.
Shall we? I feel like a lot of us here, you know, you have your hands in a lot of multiple facets of this industry, you know, here in Nashville. You're mostly a touring guy. I know you've done a lot of recording as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the photography arm.
Oh, sure.
As well. And then, as I mentioned earlier.
It's a hidden third arm.
You know, your thing. Yeah, exactly. Working at Nelson. So you have that side of the industry.
Oh yeah.
So I saw you cause you're still playing with Spencer Crandall, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think that was the last time I saw you over at Exit Inn.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That was one of the last shows they had.
Yeah, it was. It was the last week.
Yeah.
Kind of a surreal thing, because I'd only played there one other time, and it was nice to be there. I mean, I'd say nice. It's bittersweet to be there in a week like that, when the future of it was still very much in the air on what was going to happen and
yeah,
all that stuff. But it was cool to get to do that, and it was, you know, I mean, sold out hometown shows, never bad.
Yeah, that was super fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was my first time even at that venue.
Oh, so yeah. Yeah, it's
you guys put on a good show.
Been there a long time. But yeah, I mean, that gig's been fun. It's been, that would have been over, was that home? That was over a year ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really busy because he just had his record come out, and we were doing a big nationwide situation on that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was cool.
Yeah. So let's get back to maybe more the beginning of you moving here and kind of like, we always like to hear about like people's mindsets and how they've achieved, you know, different levels of success. And you've been here 10 years now, so you've seen, yeah, speed bumps. But yeah, you've seen a lot of the change, probably more than most. And
I mean, yeah, it's definitely, I got here at the front end, I guess, I guess at this point you'd call it the front end, or maybe the back end of the first wave of the craziness. I moved here I was playing with a guy named Nate Nelson, but he had a project called White Violet in Athens that was signed to Normal Town Records, which is an imprint of New West. Mm-hmm. And he just sort of was like, man, I think I'm going to move to Nashville. Is that something? And he framed it to the whole band. And I was the only one that seemed kind of down. So we did it. And we lived over on Nolensville, right kind of near Thompson Lane, between Thompson and the Catholic Church there. So not, you know, really close to Thompson in the grand scheme of Nolensville Road. And I actually loved it there. I got the house because I'm a drummer, actually. Mm-hmm. So I'd emailed the guy. It was Craigslist.
I've never heard that before.
That seems backwards, yeah.
Yeah, because
we've denied your application because you're a drummer.
Yes.
I emailed him on Craigslist and I was like, hey, man, I know you're having an open house on this day. I'm already going to be back home. If anything happens and you can show it to me, I can be there in 15 minutes. And he said, okay. And, you know, I didn't know him. He was just a guy on the internet, you know, just another landlord on the other end of this email. And he said, I'm going to be there in a half hour. You can meet me there. It was like 5:30. So we cruised over. We were staying at his girlfriend had moved up here a few months before us. She was over off of 8th. And we cruised over there. And I got there, I was talking to Rick Shell is his name. Great dude. He's a drummer
mm-hmm.
and a singer. And I had a Chicago Drum Exchange hoodie on. Nice. So then, and he had an RCA Records, like old school jacket on.
And then conversation ensued.
Yeah, yeah. And then, so because I was a drummer and I had owned a house in Georgia, he was like, okay, you're not going to fuck up my place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's like, if everything comes back, you fill this out. If you get it to me by 7 and everything comes back fine tomorrow at noon with your like credit or whatever, house is yours.
Wow.
And he came through and he was awesome. And I lived there for a little bit less than a year. I ended up leaving that band. Originally I was not going to stay. I didn't really enjoy it here. I was going to move to LA.
Mm-hmm.
And then the arm happened.
Yeah.
And then, so that A was super expensive, and the unknownness, you know, whenever they do this into the nerve thing, nerves take about an inch a month that it takes them to heal.
Mm.
So it has to get down to kind of the middle of your forearm before you can do anything on your wrist. And anyway, I went all the way to the very end of, I already had a consult for a surgical repair of my nerve because it had gone on so long. Because I couldn't do anything. The first thing I could do was barely like twitch my wrist. And that didn't happen. Arm break happened in January, mid-January. I couldn't do that little wrist thing until the very end of July.
Wow.
So
oh, my gosh.
It was a long time. It wasn't like the bone was already healed. I was just walking around like a gimp. And
how was your mental health through that time?
Oh, it was terrible.
Because, I mean, obviously the physical recovery is priority.
Because I had already made this plan. Yeah. I had a place lined up with a friend of mine that I was going to stay. I was going to rent their bedroom. I had a month because the lease was going to be up at this house that the guy and I had been living in. And so I had a month-to-month place that I was living. Actually, I had moved I had moved the very big stuff in, and then the next day is when I broke my arm. I was also in the middle of a record, doing a record that was like, it was just a perfect storm of bullshit.
Yeah, really.
But yeah, it was bad. I mean, I drank a lot, and I ate like garbage because it's my dominant hand. I can't do anything with it. I can't hold anything because while I can grip it, I can't keep anything stiff, so it just would flop around. So I couldn't do dishes. And so to not be a weight on my roommate, I just ate. If I couldn't eat it with one hand and clean it with one hand, I didn't do it. So that meant I just ate absolute garbage.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's not good for anybody either. And it was definitely a dark time. I also remember that year is the coldest, might be the coldest it's ever been consistently here. It was below 5 degrees for like 4 days.
Yeah.
And that house was like, crappy house off of Riverside that had no central heating and air. So I just had one of those like wall heaters.
Yeah.
And I remember I slept in a sleeping bag in my bed with the comforter and everything because it was just so cold in the house.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, it could have been better.
Were there moments of like, I may not even have this career anymore?
Absolutely. Like, absolutely. I mean, the orthopedic surgeon, I also had a whole thing with an orthopedic surgeon and I had to go to a different one because of like an office insurance fuck up before it even happened. But he was really cool. He had lived in New Orleans for a long time, was a big music fan, and he was really positive the whole time, which was helpful. And he wasn't just giving you the facts like a lot of doctors will. He was really upbeat and was like, man, I really think it's going to work itself out because all of the bone stuff was fine. You just rarely have this kind of thing happen where all that other stuff goes just swimmingly. You're healing, you know, the skin and all the muscles healed up nicely over the incision. The bone is healed. The nerve's just going to take a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And he was right, and it ended up working out. But I do remember the first weekend that I went out that I did play two gigs in that time with a brace.
Gosh.
And I didn't – one of them the artist knew because it was my friend. The other one I didn't tell them. Because it was just like pounding eighth notes out and it was all mid-tempo and I was like, I can handle this.
Yeah.
But my buddy was playing for, he asked me in March because he had gotten this big tour and she gets this kind of, not really last minute, but you know, comparatively, do you want to do this gig with, he was playing with Olivia Jean and do you want to do this gig opening for Pixies in June? And I was like, I'll be fine by June. Yeah, man.
Yeah.
I wasn't fine by June.
Yeah.
And so we had a rehearsal and I didn't know anything about Olivia and, but she was signed to Third Man. So we rehearsed at Jack's place, which was cool, but
that was cool.
But my hand doesn't work. Like it just, I can squeeze and it's in a brace, but I can't open it. So I can't shake someone's hand with my right hand.
Yeah.
So he comes out and he's like, oh man, nice to meet all you guys. And he's shaking everybody's hand. And then I do the reach over with my left hand.
Oh man.
And then that was the last day of the rehearsal. And then afterwards she was like, so what's the deal with the brace? And I was like, oh, if I take it off, it does this. She was like, okay. Yeah. Well, you sounded fine.
Yeah.
So I guess it's cool.
Wow.
But then it was cool because, I mean, I played the gig that way. And at that point, it was everybody, the original members of Pixies except Paz was playing bass. So the original drummer had an injury back in the day. And he talked about that with me. And it was really cool. So, but I did that. But the first gig I did where I was like, I'm not going to wear a brace.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do any of that. I was supposed to be back. I'd been going to PT and doing all the stuff they'd been telling me to do. But I was playing with this guy, JP Harris, who's great, like traditional country artist. And he does this version of Fireman by George Strait, which is already kind of upbeat, but it's also already like, it's like 2:47. It's a short song.
Yeah.
And he's like, what if we played it faster? And added.
What if 2:47 was a tempo?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's pretty fast. And then he was like, what if we just did alternating solos at the very end of the show I'm tired of it? Yeah. Jeez. And so, I mean, my arm was just like not ready to play burning eighth notes for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And it started to do a little bit of this. And so then I was trying to play lefty. It was fine. He was like, okay, we won't let it go on that long for the next two shows. And
that's
was cool about it. And I prefaced it. I was like, hey man, I should be fine. We had rehearsals. It was all fine. So he felt confident it could happen. He just, I think it was a good night and he was just pushing it to let it go. And then it was chill. But that's really the only time I've ever really had a problem on a gig with it. to be honest, yeah. Since then. I mean, every once in a while I'll have some pain because there's a plate and 11 screws in my arm, but
yeah. Understandable.
Otherwise, yeah. I don't really have a lot of issues. It's normally I probably like sleep on it weird and put a lot of pressure, and mm-hmm. that's usually why it hurts the next yeah. day. But it's seldom. The only time that's ever been really scary is it didn't hurt until I did this. I was staying with my brother in California, and I remember I was on tour, and I just wanted to hang out with him, so I stayed at yeah. his place, and I got in the shower and did this, and it was like felt like someone just put a knife right in my bicep, oh my and gosh. I was like, oh God.
Yeah, jeez.
So otherwise, that's fine. But, you know, because of that, though, that kept a lot of the orthopedic surgeon who ended up doing it was in Georgia, which is where I'm from. And I was making a lot of back and forth still. And I was still, you know, I hadn't been here long enough for those connections to have been severed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was doing some stuff here and there. And towards the end of my time living in Georgia, I had done a few gigs with Cindy Wilson of the B-52s as
awesome.
Different, like, the first gig, I met her because I was playing when I was in Georgia. I was playing with a Beatles cover band, and we played mm-hmm. everything up through Revolver, nothing cool. like later. And they hired us for her son's birthday party. So we came and we played, and they loved it. And then they hired us for their Christmas party. And then at the Christmas party, they wanted us to learn a couple songs she was going to sing. So we did that. Someone was there that was the talent booker for the High Museum of Art, which is the big art museum in Atlanta. Hmm. And they were going to do the Salvador Dali exhibit. And the songs that she wanted us to learn were 60s psychedelic, like, garage songs. So they were like, oh, it'd be great if we could get her, like, a bigger name to do this opening, Salvador Dali opening party.
For the exhibit.
That was yeah. all this, like, 60s psych music. Mm-hmm. So we did that. And then, you know, it just became one of those things where she wasn't really out here trying to necessarily do a solo thing. And it just sort of, she had done some in the past, but it wasn't on the radar. I mean, the B-52s at this point were still pretty busy. They were doing like a tour with Blondie and then somebody else. I mean, they were going. And so then we did a few shows, and then they get really busy where she's like, we can't really do this. So sure, that's fine. And I would play some gigs here and there with whatever. But then, you know, later she had like a phone call with me and one of the other guys that I played with. And she was like, would you guys want to record some stuff? So we were doing some of that. And one of the guys I had played, and he is a recording engineer and like multi-instrumentalist in Athens. And I had done a bunch of stuff with him in the past. We had gone, I mean, I say a bunch. That's an understatement. We'd done like U.S. tours. I'd been to Asia with him to play stuff. And I mean, countless records. He hired me a ton or had hired me on behalf of artists a ton to do a bunch of session stuff in Athens. So mm-hmm. we started working on a record, and that was kind of going on in the back burner. And then she got it to a point where she was happy and it came out. And while that's happening, I'm just doing random gigs around town. I mean, I never really did a whole lot of Broadway. Not for any particular reason, just how mm-hmm. how it all worked out.
Yeah.
But I fell into that Americana, like old school country world, just because I don't know. That's just how it worked out.
That's what you vibed with.
Yeah, I think it's just who I met. You know, yeah, honestly,
yeah.
One of the first guys I met was Dave Martin, who's another drummer, and he's great. And he was in that world, and he had been here a minute, so he was. I'd just hang out with him, and that's what we'd go do. And
yeah,
you know, go to Robert's, see Don Kelly on Sunday night. Go
nice.
I mean, this is also way before the American Legion was ever a thing on a Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And
I didn't get to that.
Yeah. and so I just sort of fell into that, and there was a lot of, you know, smaller tour here or there. And I never really fell into anything really big until I was doing. What year was this? 2016. This is when Cindy's record was going to finally come out, and so we were going to do some shows, and I was playing with Nikki Bloom at the time because I got to know Ken Coomer, and he had played on the record, and she needed a guy live, and I was doing that, and then I had a lot of stuff happening all at one time, both professionally and then also in my personal life, and
it's funny how that tends to happen, right?
Oh yeah, man, it's. Yeah. And
It's like the laws of the universe or something.
Yeah. So I was doing Nikki, and Nikki's thing was, even though she was Nashville based, it was more kind of rock tour thing where we'd go out for 4 weeks, and we did four-week runs 1 year. So it was a lot. And then in between that, I was doing this, trying to do the Cindy stuff and get it off the ground. And then the Cindy record is, every song is double track drums. And it's either me playing two very different parts and drum sounds, or me and Sterling Campbell. And Sterling has been the longtime drummer for the B-52s, but he also played for David Bowie, still currently plays for Soul Asylum from time to time, and a lot, and Cyndi Lauper. I mean, just a monster of a player and a great dude. And I met him on the, like, he was in town for the session, and, you know, I met him then, and he called me randomly, was like, dude, the B-52s decided to do very minor tracks, but it was mostly they wanted just a click so that they could keep the show like consistent tempo night to night, but it go to everybody. So they're like, whatever, let's do tracks. We'll just throw a little bit of like loops and perk in, especially from those records that have a lot of production. Mm-hmm. And the guy that was their tech, when they made that decision, was like, I'm not going to learn Ableton. So they let him go. And they went through a few
What not
dudes.
To do.
Well, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was an old guy.
That's like textbook. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
I think he just wanted to be done. Now knowing what I know and all that stuff, I think he was, I mean, he was probably the oldest person except for the production manager.
And I don't mean to talk down on him. I don't know that person. But that's also something to be said. Like, if you're respectful about knowing what you don't want or what you maybe can't.
Absolutely.
It's like, no, this gig is not for me anymore, and I'm going to give it to someone that wants it. You know?
Exactly. And so they had a couple of guys who were like adjacent drummers. That was not their primary thing. So they could do the computer part, but the tuning became the problem, or their availability. Mm. And it just kept going down the line, and he was like, man, we had a guy and I thought he was going to be good and it didn't work out. Could you sub on this? And I was like, sure. And then that turned into me teching for kind of a minute, because it really wasn't supposed to be that many shows. And then just some stuff sort of happened. And I was like, well, I'm not, this all like perfectly aligns with, obviously Cindy's not going to be doing anything in that time. And it worked out where Nikki wasn't doing anything, because it was like four weeks on and then like a big, huge break.
Yeah.
So I was doing that. And then the Cindy thing really started to pick up some steam in the off season of the Bees. And then the Nikki thing sort of just went away. And so I was doing all that and sort of came to and then also just taking any random gig or session that someone called me for. I mean, so it was a little like insane. And the Nikki thing didn't necessarily end of my accord. It was her decision and it was sort of a surprise. So we'll come back to that, but I just want to set that for the stage. And then the Cindy thing was also not like a true solo project. It was a band, legally. We were all a member. Mm-hmm. We got to do some really cool stuff. I went all over the U.S. and there was a lot. I mean, it was so easy to get press stuff because you have a huge name. And did that mean that people necessarily came to the shows? No. But was it easy to just be like, email NPR and get an interview? Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
They'd immediately like email you back, which is not the case with anything. And then, you know, the guy who was the multi-instrumentalist producer ended up walking away from the band, and I hired Reese Williams, who's a fucking awesome dude here that plays keys and bass and sings, because that gig was a tough gig. I'm not like going to sugarcoat it. It did not stop. Once we started, it was 73 minutes long, and it went the whole way through transitions. There was a video element that we set up a projector and a screen every night.
Wow.
There was no count-ins other than everybody had to memorize. I played a specific fill to start every song, and that's how everybody knew the song starts, because we'd just like wash out in between songs while these visuals, you know, it was very, very psyched out visuals as well. And you know, that's a whole rig. You got to have, we had a Mac Mini mounted in a rack unit with a Scarlett 18i20 and all this other stuff. And then we weren't running the tracks from Ableton. We were running it all from Cubase, because we had to time align all of the video so that we could, and it wasn't one just giant video thing. Because at the time, Ableton just did not like video. Mm-hmm. You could technically do it, but not like that.
Yeah.
And
I'm sure now it's different.
Right. It's definitely a little better now. It's not amazing still, mm-hmm. but it also allowed us to rearrange the set. Whereas yeah. Ableton at the time, it was like, it would freeze.
Yeah.
It was pretty gnarly.
I was just going to ask, were you kind of the lead on those parts in terms of all the gear and the
video? I became the lead, especially once the producer guy split. I had to run it all, which also meant I had to learn Cubase, which I had had zero experience with and is not a user-friendly thing.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. I mean, because it doesn't work anything like... The closest thing I've worked with is either Final Cut or... And it's even different than that. Final Cut or Adobe Premiere. Mm-hmm. But it works more in that kind of interface than an audio interface. Mm-hmm. And it's not fun at all to work in for what we were doing. And so it went for a while, and then, man, we had a manager debacle that we went to Europe. The first three shows in the UK were four shows in the UK were fine. We had a liaison that's like, which is, I mean, it's great if you ever have like a promotion company, send a liaison. You don't, that's just part of the deal. Mm-hmm. They're there to help you. They settle for you. They give you the breakdown. They give you the money, but they also like, they know all the stuff around the club because they go to these places all the time. And they're like, oh, this place is open after the show. You can get food here. I mean, it's just, was sick.
Yeah,
it was awesome. But they traveled separately too, so you didn't have to like worry about them in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and then we get to mainland Europe, and the first show I get there, and the guy at the club's like, oh, here's the updated contract with the reduced guarantee. And I was like, what are you talking about?
Yep.
So I was like, I need to call the booking agent. So, and it's Europe, and they have like work-life balance there, but this is an emergency. So I'm just blowing his phone up, and then he finally calls me back, and I was like, man, I'm really sorry to bother you, but this guy, I'm at this club, and he's saying that there's a this thing. Is, do you know anything about this? Has this been agreed upon? And he was like, oh yeah, your manager agreed to this. Like weeks and months ago.
Yeah.
No one knew.
Yeah.
And I even went back through our emails, and that was never mentioned. I went through it. We had a Slack at the time, and I went through that, and none of that was mentioned. And then I was like, okay, yeah, I didn't know. And then the fucking hammer fell. And he was like, I guess you don't know about Germany then. And I was like, I guess I don't. And every gig in Germany had been converted to a door deal. And I was like,
ooh, nope.
And we just, I mean, we hemorrhaged. It went from breaking even to absolutely hemorrhaging cash. And since it was a band, I had fronted the flights. Cindy fronted the hotels. And, you know, we came home and I paid every vendor. I paid Reese because he was the only hired guy. And there was no money to pay anybody back for anything. So I had $9,000 of fucking flights on a credit card.
Oh, man.
And I didn't get paid. And I was gone for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So I just like hemorrhaged equipment.
So after you assaulted the manager.
I've actually never seen him again.
that's great.
I fired him from Belgium. And I wrote 60 emails to every vendor, and I scheduled all of them to send at the same time so that there was no question.
Yep.
And just said, like, effective immediately, I am the point of contact for this, which, I mean, it was not how you want to spend the downtime before a show.
No.
But, you know, and I've never seen him. I have talked to him, like, online a couple of times early, like, closer to that. But... And I mean, he technically was owed money for the shows that he had helped facilitate, but like I didn't get ultimately reimbursed for those flights until like 3 years later.
Oh my God.
When we dissolved the LLC, that was part of my deal, as I was like, I'll dissolve this and walk away from any future royalties, but I need reimbursed for this.
Man.
Yeah.
And so like, I mean, yeah, we didn't pay him, but it's also, there was no money. After that, we never played another show after the Europe run with Cindy. She's doing stuff again and with some other cats, which is totally fine. And I have, you know, there's no bad blood with Cindy and I. Mm-hmm. But it definitely, there's definitely bad blood with me and the manager.
Yeah,
I definitely don't ever want to see him again. And
understandable.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure all of it made his life complicated too. You know, I'm not going to downplay that, but it like really...
What a fair take. my friend. Most people would not have the emotional maturity to be like, well, I'm sure that was hard for him as well.
Well, yeah, I don't
fuck that guy.
I think he was in a bad place.
Yeah.
And I don't think that he was necessarily thinking it was going to implode like it did.
Yeah.
I think it was a perfect storm that in some degree he helped set in motion, but I don't think that even that was even on his radar as a possibility for how it would all play out.
Right.
Which and makes sense. It was definitely because, I mean, we were like working on merch numbers. I had averages from the U.S. And so we were working on like, oh, we'll sell enough of this or that. And we just didn't sell anything like we were selling in the U.S.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting. I mean, it's like you guys may never get another opportunity if you really like this music to see it or to buy merch for it. And shipping it from the U.S. is going to be expensive. So like. But there were Europe tour shirts that were explicit for that tour. So just stuff like that.
So this is, from what you're describing, this is already a pretty high pressure, stressful gig from a performance aspect. But it sounds like you were also like quasi tour manager. Your first gig having to do all that?
Yeah, there was another situation, which is why the manager wasn't there to begin with that I'm not going to get into. That was a last minute thing. So I became the tour manager by de facto. within 48 hours of departure for this tour.
Wow.
So it became, I mean, it was a lot of stress. I still drank then and it was in full effect. I even skipped the craziest part of the whole fucking tour.
Oh, tell us.
The craziest part is I booked an Airbnb. We were in Scotland, played Glasgow, and there was the big rugby match that's like Scotland versus England, and it was in Glasgow. So every hotel was like £500 or €500, whatever. And I was like, well, that's not in budget. So I found an Airbnb we were going to have to drive almost back to England, like proper out of Scotland. It was at the very edge of Scotland. And they didn't have as many beds as they said they did. They were one short. It was a couch, but it really wasn't a couch. It was more of like an insanely old love seat at best size.
That's what I was going to say. It was a love seat, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but old, so it wasn't even straight. It was curved and super, super ornate. Gilded. I mean, it was crazy. And I was like, why do you just have this in an Airbnb? I guess you have more respectful people than I see most Airbnbs in America. Anyway, because I booked it and it was my fuck up, I opted to sleep on that. But between the show and all the other stressors and everything, I ended up slightly herniating my C6 disc in my neck on the couch. So I woke up and was like, I can't move anything above my shoulder blades or it hurts so bad.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, I'm going to get back. I'm just going to put all my shit that I was sleeping on the floor and I'm just going to sleep on the floor. So it's up on the floor and it was a little bit better when I woke up again and I took the hottest shower I could stand for like 35 minutes or something, just the water hitting that zone. But the weirdest, I mean, it sort of leveled out and it was really tough. I thought that maybe it was just like a weird crick or something and I was going to try to have a massage therapist look at it, but booking one day of in the window that we were going to be in, because we're driving day of show and all this stuff, I just couldn't get anything lined up. But I had a guy who was buying a cymbal from me that he, in Amsterdam. I was going to bring it with me. And he's an established guy. And I messaged him and I didn't know him. And I was like, dude, I need a favor. Do you have any connections with anyone? This is what's going on with a doctor or a massage therapist, someone that can just like look at it. And he came through and there was a physical, like a sports doctor that was like, you bring me €80. I'll look at you. We'll have an hour. I'll try to do everything I can for you. I was like, sick. Walked there. And he was the one that was like, oh, you've got a herniated C6 disc. I can't do anything. You can't do anything. Don't lift anything over 50 pounds. Try to not do anything stupid with it.
Good God, man.
Be whatever. But the hardest part was I couldn't. That is where the nerve to your arm comes down. So I couldn't feel my index finger on my right hand. So I played the whole rest of the shows. I mean, which was the whole mainland leg of Europe with no.
How many weeks was that?
It was just like another week and a half or something. And then there was one more show in the UK. So there was that show plus those shows. So it was like 2 weeks total of shows. But
it probably felt like months, right?
Yeah. And I just felt bad because then that meant everybody else had to carry. I could only carry the light stuff. And I mean, it's drums.
Yeah.
they're heavy inherently.
Yeah, you physically couldn't.
Yeah. And then, yeah, I mean, it was a whole thing, but I made it through. But anyway, just like in that world, my personal life, both my immediate thing and some family stuff, all like coming to a head. I'm just, this is when I stopped drinking, because I just sort of like made some decisions and I just burned a lot of my personal life down. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was that was not a great thing. And then, you know, there was a period where I lost a lot of things all at one time, gig wise, not necessarily because of related to that. Some of it was unrelated to anything, just sort of like all was a perfect storm of bullshit within 1 year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The music industry.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's, and life in general.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, and all these things sort of went away for a little while, the teching thing. Obviously the Nikki thing and the Cindy thing. So it was just sort of a rebuilding time. And I did some tours with different artists that were great, like Brandy Zidan, who's a great kind of more like rock leaning singer songwriter. Her now husband was just like, he was playing with it. He was, you know, he was doing the juggle and he had to do something else. And that was a fun run. And, just did a bunch of other random stuff. I mean, I got to do some really big gigs. I subbed for Berlin, the band Berlin, which was awesome. And I got to do some really great big shows with that, which is cool.
Yeah.
And we played the Sugar Bowl pre party outside the Superdome in Orleans, which was sick and a lot of fun. They actually used Ableton with video and it worked pretty well, but they had, I don't know who set it up, but they were a ninja because the way that it was set up.
Yeah.
And it flowed and it was cool. But they just weren't running straight through either. It was it used like a launch pad to launch every song. But that started as a sub thing. And I did a few of those. And that was really cool. If I lived in LA, they would have offered me the gig once the guy left or they fired him or whatever the deal was. I got a call and asked if that was something I would potentially entertain. And I was like, man, just right now in my life, that just doesn't make sense. Yeah. I would really like to do it. But it was cool to be considered because, I mean, there were some good names. Blair Senta auditioned. I mean, even to be in that thing. I mean, that guy's a monster.
Yeah.
An under the radar.
Yeah. Guy he's got the whole recording.
Man.
Education stuff down, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He does that. But I mean, he's done Josh Groban and a bunch of other like pretty big. And he's been doing Fits in the Tantrums and Pink Spiders. I mean, he's just a great dude and a monster player.
Yeah.
So.
Man, it's inspiring just hearing like just your journey even from those years, like just all the setbacks you've had. Yeah. And
well, that's just how it is.
And just like going back to like that first, was it a Christmas party or a holiday party with Cindy?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's a lesson right there. It's like you never know who's going to be at that gig.
Absolutely.
You know, and some of those small, low-pressure gigs, but like I'm sure you had the professional mindset to just, well, I'm going to give it my all. And then look how that progressed, you know?
I mean, and to be honest, we knew that it was like going to be a big enough thing. Mm-hmm. That and it's a party for their friends and family. I mean, she's been in the business. At that point, it was like 35 years or something. Like,
yeah,
they're gonna be some people there that could do something for somebody,
yeah, exactly.
Whether it's me or one of the other guys that have their own solo projects or whatever. But, yeah, I mean, and there's been some recording stuff here and there. I'm trying to think of what other like project things have come through that I mean, and then after that, basically, the shortest version of some of that stuff is I ended up falling in with this so this is one of my favorite facts. Billy Bennett's recording engineer, great, also a great musician, but he's from Athens and I knew him in Athens. And then I got to know him up here. He lived with the guys from Los Colones, Mort and Jay, if you know those guys. But Billy worked at Bomb Shelter for a long time when he moved here. And they had a place behind their house, too. Yeah, man.
I've only recorded there once, but it was a great time.
Oh, man, it's great. And it's even better now. I mean, Andre has done so much build out there. Like, the Studio B room is so much nicer than when I remember first doing some stuff in there.
Yeah, that's good.
It's just a great space. Yeah. And Billy did, like, the first Wiggs record and the first big EMGMT record. He did all this stuff. But what's hilarious is that he was like the NCAA. He held like 30 NCAA records because he was the kicker for UGA.
Whoa.
For his entire college career. And had just like 60 SEC records. and he was the kicker, and that was it.
That's insane.
I mean, you can still look up. He had an incredible amount of records. It's all, and yeah. But he's so cool and like can turn that world on.
Yep.
And it'd be funny to be like at shows with him in Athens and some old guy come up and be like, "You're Billy Bennett. I remember when you kicked that, whatever, you know." And it was really, really nice. But yeah, anyway, he's a
local legend.
Yeah. And this guy, there's this guy, Reed Turchie, who did and still does a lot of recording at Bomb Shelter. Like a blues artist, sort of that North Mississippi Junior Kimbrough style thing, at least at the time. It's morphed a little bit since then, his world. But he got to know Billy, and Billy was like, "Man, you need a guy to play drums. Call my buddy Lemmy. He's great." So, man, I played with Reed from that point until, honestly, like 2.5 years ago, mm-hmm. like coming out of the pandemic. I was on the road with Reed when the pandemic shut everything down.
Wow.
It was a weird time.
What was that like? Because you mentioned, we were talking before, you worked at a wood shop during the pandemic.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah, yeah. And that was because of music drum friends. Mm-hmm. My buddy Jacob Edwards, who gave me, also did that Olivia Jean gig. He was a dude I met early on. I had a family member that I took care of. This is pre-pandemic, unrelated to that, mm-hmm. that I like was financially responsible for. So when the pandemic shows up and there's at Tennessee unemployment's a joke. It maxes out at 225 or something like that. I mean, 4 weeks of that ain't going to pay anybody's rent in Nashville.
Yeah.
That's just the facts. So I had to figure something out. And I mean, a little bit of that was I worked at Nelson. We weren't open, but we were just trying to get everything online. And I did that. But then, you know, then that's done. And that's like, okay, well, I need something else, man. And so I was doing this sketchy-ish. It was like just because of the climate of health, but like I was a medical courier.
Oh, wow.
And that puts you at risk. Because
what does that even entail? I'm not
so it's it is not there. There's medical courier companies. There's actually one that's in this same like vicinity. It's over here, and okay. I'd go drop for them. But they, yeah. This one was contracted, and so they were technically third party. So they weren't there, and they're just a local only. So what that entails generally is I have a tablet. They would call me, say, "Hey, we've got a thing here. It needs to go here." And then you could say, "Yep, send it over." They send it to your tablet, and it could be anything from me going to the Walgreens Minute Clinic and picking up like this blood sample that needs to be ran at Vandy or whatever, to I need to transport. It's anything that minor to I had multiple livers and kidneys in my car to take.
Wow.
To, you know, when that happens, you go and you have to wait. And that's the deal. And, you know, that they tell you that up front, you know, you're supposed to be there, but there's someone that's passed on and they're an organ donor and they're going to cut all the organs out. And then you just have to wait and you have to be ready because time is of the essence. And as soon as they're ready, you know, that you sign all the docs, they sign all the documentation they need to. And then I would normally drive directly to the private airport. And there was a company that handled that at the private airport, and I would turn it over to them. But then they're like, that company has their own tracking. So you'd have to call them and say, "Hey, I've got this. This is the like 6-digit hex code for this organ. This is this organ. This is this organ. I'm taking them here. I estimate to be there in 15 minutes. If you're not there in 20, they're going to call you and be like, where are you at?"
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it was a,
what a unique thing. I've never even heard of that.
Oh yeah.
As a thing.
It's a, I mean, and dude, it is a thing here.
You hear people like the healthcare industry, odd jobs and Uber and Lyft. And,
yeah. I mean, and there's a few musicians, which is how I got it. My buddy Rob Mitchell was doing it because his buddy, Michael Petrantoni, who's a great guitar player. He trained me actually, and he was awesome. But it was a lot to remember. Think about any hospital you've ever been in and how complicated it is. I'd have to go in cold and find a place that's usually not labeled like the lab or the pharmacy.
Mm-hmm.
And the pharmacy runs were probably the most like controlled beside the organs because you'd have to sign a bunch of things like 10 pill bottles worth of Oxycontin to this other pharmacy that needs it today because something happened.
And yeah.
It'd be all kinds of stuff like that. Or it might even just be documents that they need. Or like I picked up a DVD one time that was, there was some reason that they needed it to be a hard copy of all of these scans they had done for a guy.
Mm-hmm.
It was a cool gig. And I actually did it even once stuff got to be cooking again, like musically.
Mm-hmm.
I did it and the owner was super nice to me and really flexible. And I worked there for, I mean, on and off as long as I made it work. But you could, if you're a workaholic, which I definitely probably fall into that category a little bit, you could never stop working. Yeah. It was literally a 24/7 job. They worked every single day of the year.
Mm-hmm.
If you worked Christmas and stuff, like there was an hourly bonus and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was a pay per job. It was a 1099 thing. So yeah. Like, you know, some job might pay like $8 if you're just going to pick it up in Midtown and take it down the street. But then I'd get called to go to Jackson to take, I mean, there were two whole days that I delivered all of the computer equipment that went to this new Vandy clinic. And I had a van that was like the thing. It was,
man, that's wild.
It was a weird job, but I got to listen to a ton of music since it was like a break. You know, I had all these breaks. It wasn't just straight. This guy, the Groove Index, which I don't even know if he's doing anything, but he made a bunch of playlists at the very beginning of the pandemic, like 6 hours long of specific drummers.
Yep.
And I would listen to the same one for the whole week. That was my rule. So I'd listen to like the Josh Freese one for a whole week, the James Gadson one for a whole week, the Jay Belarose one for a whole week, which was a really great education for their, I mean, it's the best you can do when there's no music happening.
Seriously. Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, then I just was like, I can't keep doing this. Yeah. Oh man, yeah. They're sick. I can send you the link to one of them.
Please.
So, and then I fell into the wood shop thing because I just wanted something like,
yeah.
That wasn't, I mean, I was putting insane miles on my car.
Yeah.
And I just bought it. So I did the wood shop thing. And that was a lot of drummers, actually. There were four drummers that worked there, mm-hmm. which is crazy. But I worked there and then it just ran its course for me. It was not a good time for me.
Yeah.
It was a very repetitive job. I built wood art and I had like a template I had to follow and I did the same thing every single day.
Hey, drummers. Do you need a place in Nashville to practice on actual drums? Drumbox is Nashville's newest drum practice studio. Book sessions online and get the space to yourself. It's fully equipped with two kits, cymbals, hardware, and even sticks are provided. 30-minute, 1-hour, and 2-hour sessions are available at www.drumbox.space. And use the coupon code NDP25 for 25% off your first session. Again, that's www.drumbox.space.
During this time is when you first started working at Nelson's too, right?
No. I'm the oldest employee at Nelson.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I worked at every location.
I did not realize that.
I had a backline company with Ken Coomer and Jacob Edwards where we had vintage drums for backline. And we did that for a while. And then there were just too many people doing it at one time. And it got to be, and then guys were just buying their own kits. So we decided to stop. And I mean, at that point I had 15 or 16 kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was insane.
So fast forward to present day, you're the shop manager.
Yeah. And so I had met Bryson when he was just selling like online and you could go to his house.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought a Rogers drums from him, something else, maybe another time. And I had all these drums on Craigslist and he had his first day at the first weekend at the new shop when it was like a brick and mortar. Over on McFerrin, and he sold like almost all the inventory.
Yeah.
And he was like, would you want to consign these? And that reestablished the connection. And he was like, you have a lot of like stuff and you know what it is. Is this something that if I needed someone to cover, you could help me cover? So the first guys to like cover anything there were like me, Asa, Nathan Stone.
Is that your first like retail experience in the industry?
No, I'd worked at Guitar Center.
Oh, that's right, Guitar Center. Yeah.
Then before that, I taught lessons. Well, the place I took lessons at early on in Georgia was this place called Drums 101 in Gainesville.
Mm-hmm.
And Aaron Hughes was the owner. And man, he was a really, he probably is the reason I'm not too much of a ding dong. I would be way more of a ding dong without his influence. He was just really good at keeping my head straight about a lot of music, like being musical more than that's probably the best way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very gracious. I mean, I was young. I went to, yeah, well, this is going to be a tangent, but yeah. I worked there and then there's a whole lot of other bullshit that doesn't matter. But it closed very suddenly. But there was a music store next door that carried everything except drums. And they were like, oh, well, we're obviously going to have drums now. So I was teaching at Drums 101, and then I was teaching at this music store. And I would also work at both of them if they needed somebody to cover. Mm-hmm. So that was that world. But yeah, I mean, Aaron was really great to me. And he's a monster player, and honestly, kind of a musical savant. You could play anything, and he could transcribe it almost instantly. It was nuts, so you man.
He was that guy.
He was wild, and his favorite thing to do on Saturdays, which is the day he like almost always worked, was we had a cocktail, one of those Club Jordan kits when they were new, because I'm old, and he would play Eagles songs on it because he thought it was funny. Because it sounded so different. So he would just, from memory, just play an Eagles song straight through, straight down, if it was slow. But, I mean, at this time...
It's just so highly specific. I love...
Oh, that was his world.
And only someone who truly had every piece of it memorized would get a kick out of that. That's so funny.
Yeah, to have... Because it had like an 8-inch tom.
Yeah.
And an 8-inch snare, I think. It was a tiny, tiny snare drum. The tiniest snare drum Yamaha's ever made, if I'm not mistaken. He had a fixed hi-hat and a sloshy hi-hat. Those were the only cymbals on it. Like little 10, and then the two 14s were the sloshy. So it was just very hilarious. Anyway, the interesting thing is, like, music was like a weird pivot. I went to college to be a mechanical engineer.
Oh, wow.
I was at Georgia Tech and teaching lessons at Drums 101. So I was driving an hour one way every day to make this like work out, because I had a crazy student load. I just sort of fell into it. I got very lucky, and it maintained that way until truly the fallout of the housing crisis in 2008. And then from there, still a healthy student load for a long time, but it just never recovered. And it wasn't like there was some other game in town. If anything, every other option went away. Mm-hmm. And there was just... It was a very middle class heavy zone of the state, and I mean that just decimated their money, and it never really like came back in that way. But because going to school for something so technical, and you're like, I could be really technical on the drums. There's so much technique.
Yeah,
and he was totally. Like, yeah, that's cool, but like, when is it musical? He got me into 10 Summoner. He actually bought me Sting's 10 Summoner's Tales, and he was like, this is peak technical and musical.
Yep.
You'll never, if it's more technical than this, it's too far. Yeah. And you can still be musical and be less than this, but this is where the two lines cross.
Yeah.
And I mean, I burned that record apart, and it even had a skip in the second last song on the CD because I scratched it, and that's in my brain still because I listened to it to such a degree.
Wow.
So when I listened to it straight through and I get to that song that doesn't skip, I was like, oh yeah, it's not supposed to do that.
That's a really good point, though. I mean, and it's interesting. I didn't know that about you, that you had that mechanical engineering background.
Yeah, yeah.
But
I'm
like,
fucking madman.
I think that there's obviously definite tie over in terms of us as drummers. Like, we want to be so proficient on the instrument and be technical. It's very easy to be technical, right? Learning rudiments and learning how to play different things on the drums. But like you said, is it musical?
Yeah.
Like, it kind of has to come back to that at some point.
Yeah. And, because I started so late in the game, I didn't like grow up playing drums. I think it was a really important thing, although I still wouldn't say I don't think I'm a very technical player. And a lot of that went away with the arm, to be honest.
Yeah, sure.
What technique? I had a lot of facility and literal power just because I had played so many rock gigs, and my like forearms were just considerably more developed than they are now. And I just didn't really have the desire to shed it back up at that moment. And I still don't. It's just not... I've never been called for something in very few things in Nashville where that was really required.
Right.
And so now I just don't care. I think I would love to still be able to do it. And I have definitely been practicing at it more because I think it would be a lot of fun. But because especially something like the Spencer gig allows for that if I wanted it to.
Mm-hmm.
But, this other gig I've been doing recently as well is very much... I could do a little bit of it, but not a lot. It's very 90s country, straight down the line, no tracks. So you could get those like technical setups, almost like big band style setups that they did on those songs, but it's not anything past
that. Yeah, well, I was going to go there next, just the Spencer gig, because he's, For those unfamiliar, he's one of those up-and-coming bigger names, gaining more traction for sure.
Yeah, he's interesting because he's like a TikTok, one of the early TikTok guys. He got on.
And he seems I don't really know him. I know I have some good friends that have written with him and worked with him in different regards, but he seems like the sweetest, nicest guy.
Yeah, he's great. And it is an interesting gig, though, because of the nature of it all. It's not, because before, my world in modern country, or the modern side of it, I just hadn't really wanted to dip into. The pandemic happens. I'm like, I'm working at this fucking job that I hate. But I was able to buy a house because I had a steady paycheck. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, so there's benefits to this. I would rather, but in that moment, I'm there and I'm like, I would literally rather play any music on planet Earth than be here, which was a big paradigm shift for me. So I still did the stuff with like some of the other things, but I made a concerned effort to get into this thing. And I had lunch with a few guys who were in that world. And one was Tom Myers, who's a great guy. And he plays for Future Birds, which is hilarious because they're Athens boys that I've known forever. And he does that gig. But he was playing with Kylie Morgan, who at the time, you know, she was just getting started. She was also an early TikTok kind of modern country pickup thing, but she was signed to Universal. Mm-hmm. So, I did one. I was going to sub for him on something, or we talked about like, oh man, yeah, could you sub? And I was like, yeah, I'll check out some of the tunes or whatever. 2 days later, he falls off a ladder, shatters his ankle.
Oh my gosh.
Shatters. And the doctor's like, dog, you can't fly. You might be able to play the gig with a left foot thing, but you can't fly. You'll have with the amount of cutting we're about to do on your leg, you'll have a blood clot, and I'd be really, really concerned for your safety. Mm-hmm. So I do the gig, super last minute. And I also tour manage it. This is Kylie Morgan. Okay. Yeah, Kylie Morgan, which she's awesome. And I did a lot of the shows because then Tom gets the Future Birds gig and it really picks up. So I was doing a lot of the Kylie stuff. And then I was kind of juggling some things because she wasn't super duper busy, but there was enough there. She was doing a lot of radio, a lot of duo things with Dylan that plays guitar on that gig. Mm-hmm. And it was cruising along. And then it kind of got to a point where my buddy Nathan Knox had been playing with Spencer. And this is December of 2021 or whatever, fall of 2021, winter. And he was playing with Briston Maroney and Spencer. And they had a tour and they were going to go back to back. Like he was going to do the Briston thing, then straight into the Spencer gig. Well, both of the tours get canceled because of COVID stuff. Then they get rescheduled literally on top of each other. And so he has to make a decision. Uh-huh. And he was like, hey, would you want to sub for me? It'll be for a whole tour, which is kind of a weird sub ask.
Yeah, right.
But I was like, yeah, man, I'm down. You're my boy. It's yours when I'm done. Like, you tell me when you want to come back.
So you said yes without even really checking out Spencer's music? Or did you already know? Like,
I mean, I had
because is that your mindset? You're like, well, I'm going back into this yes, music thing. Like, exactly. Wherever it takes me.
Yeah, and so I didn't even really listen to it. Yeah. I mean, I listened to a couple songs and I was like, yeah, whatever, this is fine. The honest answer is, it's Nashville. You're probably not going to throw anything at me that I can't handle. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like I got to show up and just... I mean, maybe I would never want to follow Jeremy Abbott on a gig because that guy's facility is just absolutely insane and so musical. But like, you know, most other things I could probably at least play the record part, you know, without a lot of work. So I did that tour with Spencer and it was the one opening for Lauren Elena and we had a good time and it was cool. And then Briston's world like really took off and I don't think Nate ever played another gig. He was definitely asked, and that was the deal I had with management. And it definitely was a weird thing. I made it very clear I'm not trying to snake anybody's gig. And I was like, I only want to do them. You got to ask Nate first. That was what I told management. I just didn't want to be that friend.
Yeah.
Because he's my boy. And then it turns out that they, you know, I did the whole summer after that. It was the same deal. He just wasn't available. They gave me the dates. But then the fall rolled around, which was the fall tour that you saw the exit in thing on, and they just didn't ask him, and they didn't tell me that they didn't ask him, and it got really awkward.
Yeah.
And I was like, man.
You're just kind of in the middle.
Because
you were trying. You were being very professional. And
Yeah. And yeah. I just assumed, because they had honored that.
Yeah.
And then, but it was cool. I mean, he ended up being busy anyway, and I don't know that it would have worked out.
Yeah.
But I did feel terrible about it. But one of the guys that like functions as... It's also an interesting gig because we split the band leader role equal. Mm. So Nathan Johnson, the guitar player, he's more of the musical decision making. So like, oh, should we do a pushes here, even though they're not on the record, you know, that kind of stuff, or mm-hmm. you should play this over that, different things like that. Yona functions as the interfacing with management, and that, and with Spencer, or anything that needs to be disseminated to the band or backwards of that. And then my world has been like, I handle all the tracks. Mm-hmm. After Nathan did a huge amount of the building because he already had so much of the files mm-hmm. and just sort of like ran with it. But I do the upkeep on it now and all this stuff.
And you're triggering all the
And that show runs pretty much like straight through. It runs straight through the into the acoustic break and mm-hmm. then straight out. And he that's just how he wants it to run.
Yeah, you crushed it on that gig. That was my first time seeing you play.
Oh,
I think I probably had already like been following you on Instagram or something like that. I was like, oh, I need to check this guy out.
Yeah, I mean, but I'm just ding-donging around on my purple drum set up there. Yeah.
We sort of talked a little bit about how, I mean, Spencer in particular, you know, kind of came from this TikTok content-driven world. What I'm curious, just your general thoughts on, not necessarily him, like, is that right or wrong, but just in this media-centric world that we all have to deal with?
Sure.
Where do you see?
Well, so the interesting thing for him, and I would say that, and it's this is explicit to country world, because the country music industry controls radio with a stranglehold.
Hmm.
Absolutely, in that regard. Other genres, that isn't the case. Pop, rock, you can pierce through with enough groundswell. You could pierce through at a local station and they could maybe play it or whatever, right? But country just doesn't work that way.
Really?
In my experience, it has been that he has had some of the biggest success for someone that has absolutely, he is not signed to anything and never has been.
Yeah.
And that is cool because that means he gets to pocket way more money from everything, which allows him to do things that a lot of artists wouldn't be able to directly afford. But that also means that, like, another way that the industry works is, you know, if you have, let's say you are booking everybody for Faster Horses, the big, or whatever the big, a big country festival,
mm-hmm.
and you go to the booking agent for whoever you want to headline, pick an artist, big artist A, and they're like, we'd like to have big artist A headline this thing. A lot of times, I'm not going to say all the time, but a lot of times what happens is that booking agent's like, well, because the label has directed him that these are the small artists that need to be bumped for this year. They're looking to like build. They'll be like, well, if you want big artist A, I need you to do these three small ones on there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the deal. But if you're not signed and you're not part of that build,
someone like Spencer wouldn't necessarily be in that.
It can be tougher to crack the nut
mm-hmm.
because you don't have that like machine telling everyone that you're a big deal when you can look at an artist who's like doing one of these really big opening shows and they're like, they're maybe even their first of three or maybe even second of three. And you look at their numbers, their streaming numbers and stuff like that. And it's like, Spencer streams more than they do. By like kind of a lot.
Yeah.
And so it creates this interesting disconnect because, I mean, also that Western tour for his record entitled Western, man, we had so many shows that were sold out, which they're not necessarily always big rooms, but a sellout's a sellout's a sellout, man.
Yeah.
I mean, in some of these markets, he'd never played before.
Mm-hmm.
And to show up and sell it out, granted, it's a smaller joint or whatever, but it's also in markets that like, country music is not a big thing either.
Yeah.
And so
that's a really cool feeling. I'm sure.
It's a cool feeling, but it does like make it, I'm not about to speak for him or anything, but I can only imagine it has to be frustrating
mm-hmm.
because you're like, man, I have like on paper, all of this, it should be.
I'm checking
here.
All these boxes. I'm giving it my all. I'm,
yeah. You know. And I mean, William Morris books him. I mean, that's a huge agency and, all that stuff. So, I mean, it's been cool, but there's still challenges with that world. Yeah. Yeah. And, totally. You know, without radio, even minor radio, I mean, it's just so much money. It's that much more money. It's because it's passive. You're not having to trade a show for money, you know, and streaming is obviously the same thing, but radio is just, I mean, it's real money. It's by comparison. And cracking country radio. He was able to crack into Sirius, and he had two number ones on Sirius XM on the country station. It was cool to be there when that was the second one was happening for him. But yeah. It is weird because since then, Sirius has sort of like altered how they take in new music, and it is now more difficult even for him, who has had two successful runs on there, to get a new song them. Yeah. So at least from what I've heard, now I'm you know, disclaimer. I'm a secondhand news source here.
Yeah, exactly.
But it is something that I have witnessed, and it has been interesting in that way. So for him, it feels like it is very live by the internet, die by the internet, mm-hmm. which we know how fickle that can be. But it's been a pretty good like thing for him. I mean, we stopped at a Chipotle somewhere on the road, just like a drive day, and this woman was. She passed us in the parking lot. We were just in a van. It was just like a short little whatever. And she was like, I think that was Spencer Crandall. She comes in and just walks right up to him. We're in line.
Yeah.
She's just like not even in there. He was just driving through the parking lot. So it's like funny and interesting because that's how, I mean, that the whole thing about music is that you're able to touch people's lives and enrich their lives or speak to them or, you know, all the things that art can do for people. And it's important to them and it means a lot to them. And I mean, it's cool to see that it matters. His music matters that much to a person, and for them to come thank him and just want a photo. She was very respectful, you know, of that. Some people aren't always, but you know, it was really, it's just a great reminder. And honestly, that was a lot of my pivot to, that also informed a little bit of my pivot into the country thing, as I was like, man, it's cool to play music that you wrote and all that stuff, but it's also cool to go somewhere, play music, and every single person on that front row is singing the words.
Yes.
Yeah, man. And that does seem to be a special thing about country music. Like just the live component is just unmatched. I mean, all these festivals and local shows, local bars, and you just get people that just come out and just really are impacted by that music.
Yeah, it's so much about the identifying, because the lyrics are they're all about stories. It's all it's that. And so not only it then generates a community automatically, because you have this artist telling a story that resonates with you, and now you're here at the show and everybody else is there because of the same thing. This song resonated with them, or these songs that this artist wrote resonated with them. Now we're here all sharing this, agreeing that we all appreciate this same story, which is, it's cool because it just automatically creates community. Whereas, you know, I mean, any other genre has that same kind of thing in its own way, but it's not exactly the same, I don't think, because of the storytelling narrative that is intrinsic in country music. But yeah, that's what Spencer, I don't really know what's next.
Yeah. What's 2024 looking like with him?
I'm not sure. Yeah. You know, right now, to my knowledge, I don't have anything on the calendar. That doesn't mean anything, because again, I'm just
change
the drummer.
In a few hours. Yeah, right.
Yeah, you know, and to lead into 2024, I had this conversation with a buddy of mine who has a bigger gig, not in town. It's a salary, has been a salary gig, and the artist did not pick up the salary option for 2024, and it like turned his plan upside down, because they waited until the day before the option expired.
Wow.
Which, I mean, is a move. I don't think it was necessarily malicious. I think that they probably just were a little bit whatever. I'm going to assume it wasn't malicious. Yeah. Anyway, so that guy was sort of, he had a little bit of a freak out, and we were talking, and he was like, man, everything in this business, and in most businesses, industries, everything in this industry can change with a phone call.
Yes,
literally.
Bad for the better or for the worse, either way. Or could just change, not even for either of them. But his was that the salary option, and that's obviously a negative for him. But mine was sort of the opposite. I mean, I'm going to have a pretty busy year next year, it looks like, with this other guy who, I mean, we'll see what like is going on with Spencer, but this other guy offered me a lot of shows, and I just done a couple sub gigs with him. My buddy who was doing the gig was like, hey, dude, I'm doing something else. I want out. Is this something you'd be interested in? And so I've been doing some of that, and that's been cool. But he's, you know, it's interesting because this is another younger, like emerging artist, and obviously the TikTok element and, just social media element. I think TikTok's just the one for today.
Yeah, exactly.
But, it is interesting how heavy of a component it is for labels and for everybody and for just music. I mean, I feel like even as a side man, and I don't know if you guys feel this way, I feel like there's a huge pressure to create bullshit.
Oh yeah.
For lack of a better way.
Totally. Yeah.
Like this is meaningful content. That's one thing, but they want you to post like you playing along to some dumb fucking song or that you don't even care about because it's popular.
Yeah.
Or
right.
Like do a drum cover just of it or whatever. Second. Just like, you know, that's what I feel like even every company that if you wanted to even consider having some kind of deal with, they're so pushy about that from a lot of, not every brand, but a lot of brands.
Yeah, exactly. So it's usually about the eyeballs and impressions.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. Everybody's just listening with their fucking eyes.
And that comes at a cost because, like you said, it's a lot of times it's you're sacrificing your own taste in music or quality. Then you're just, I'm going to just play. I mean, I've been guilty of that. You know, even in this room, I've for sure like just put on like, what's the hot song right now? Let me just do like a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I'll have fun with it still, but I mean,
and there's,
it doesn't
there's,
always feel good. It's not like
yeah.
what I really want to be doing.
Yeah.
But I agree. There is like, I feel pressured to be putting out content.
And it's interesting because it is your business card.
Yeah.
At least in my experience. Yeah. I mean, I even went through and culled my, I did a massive culling of my Instagram like a year and a half ago. I just archived anything that I didn't feel like fit what I was trying to point to. I don't know if it worked or not, but it made me way more conscious because I just noticed that certain cats would do, and there's a whole other, this is a whole, getting into a whole other thing about like algorithm and.
Yeah,
and,
we could have a whole other podcast.
And that's a whole other thing. But it's just like the industry at large. I'm wondering and I'm more concerned about the long-term ramifications of that. Not because it's bad inherently, but the thing is like if I have to make a drum video and I have to edit it, I'm terrible at editing video. And if even if I do it all as one take, I still need to sync the audio, which is all of the thing is this isn't all intrinsically super complicated. None of this is all stuff I couldn't figure out how to do on YouTube or whatever. The thing is it's death by a thousand cuts because it's like, oh, I have to set up a camera. I have to film it. I have to make sure it's well lit. I have to make sure all the sounds are good. Then once I have a take that's good, I need to make sure that it looks good. Okay, and then I need to do a little bit of post-processing to the video. I need to do a little bit of mixing to the audio. Then I need to dump them back together, time align it. Then I need to export it. Then I have to write a stupid caption, and I have to upload it.
Caption is what gets me every time.
Oh, man. Yeah. Then I have to upload it to like six platforms. And, you know, now the guys who are really good at video editing are really making, what's that guy, Treasure Drums? I don't even know him.
Yeah, I've seen him on.
But his editing, his video editing is insane. And he's probably paying somebody because I would.
I've seen some of those, like, he did one where I think he was doing like a floor tom shootout.
Yep.
Right? And it's like in the edit, it's like he's playing the same groove and the drums just change.
Yeah.
And I've seen a lot of guys do that with snare.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Microphones. And
absolutely.
Stuff.
But it's a nightmare to edit.
Oh, yeah.
I did one and I was like, I want to kill myself. I just like can't.
Yeah, it's time.
I mean, and I'm into tedious things, but it's like tedious. I'm also not great in those kind of interfaces.
Yeah.
But it's mostly to get back on track. This is all about like, I wonder about the time lost from pursuing the craft itself. And just like anything, it improves you. It improves you in certain ways. And you're even going to take things from doing those videos, you know, that's still practice recording, it's still all that. It still adds into what you do, but it's like.
But it's peripheral at best.
Absolutely.
Still.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I've been thinking about that a lot for myself because I'm in a situation where I know like there are a ton of drum videos I would love to make if I had the time and either the gear myself and the ability or the money to spend on just turning them. I'm like, oh, this would be a great idea. This would be fantastic. If I just had the budget to do that for, if I just spent a month straight doing that, I could probably make a year's worth of content or more. But that would be an insane amount of money that I'd have to spend.
There's absolutely.
So I'm like, I'm damned either way. Like, okay, so I've got to find some way to do this without either destroying my wallet entirely.
Because, man, do we think that streaming royalties are bad? Dude, YouTube payout, Instagram payout money is
garbage.
Nothing.
Yeah, it's garbage.
TikTok now.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's that chef, Chef Kinley, just kind of a smartass.
Yeah.
He had on one video, he had like millions of views, $200.
That's fucking insane.
And yeah, I mean, and it also,
and 2 15-second unskippable ads.
Uh-huh.
$200, 2 million views.
Yeah,
insane.
Yeah, and that's total. That's not even like over the past month or whatever that it got to that point or whatever total, and that's how much he's total made.
Right.
So that ain't gonna pay your that'll pay your power bill.
Yeah, that's a good point. Just like doing a cost benefit analysis in terms of social media and how much you want to put into it, and I think it's important for people to just take a step back and think, well, what do I want out of it? You know, instead of just like, oh, well, I feel so much pressure. I mean, just make some
and that's true of any art stuff. Is what do you want out of it?
Yeah,
but this is like art adjacent.
Like I'm trying to be more purposeful and with more intent on my own videos in this room of what I'm putting out,
mm-hmm.
and make sure it's either music I genuinely like, or it's like, yeah, if I'm trying to get more country gigs, let me post some country covers, or let's
totally.
You know, let's make it actually meaningful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a balance for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, you can see it way on the artists. I mean, cause they have to be
I can't imagine being an artist. I feel pressured as a side man.
Oh yeah.
And I'm not, it's like, we're not even the main thing.
No. You know? And we're not going to get anywhere near the messages and replies and stuff like that. And you got to engage with
people. It's all like my drummer buddies are like, cool. Yeah. Good job.
Yeah. They're like, hey, fire emoji.
Yeah. My sister and my mom. It's like, all right, great. Yeah.
Thanks guys.
I feel good now.
Yeah.
Yeah. But for them, it's like they have to interact with these fans. And I'm not saying that's bad, but man, it is like why you have to pay to do a VIP thing, because you can't have like Maren Morris just go out to the merch booth. She'd be there for 6 hours.
Right.
Yeah. You have to put a limiting factor. And in this case, once an artist gets to a certain level, that's a VIP thing. But in the social media world, everyone's accessible
to a
degree.
There is no, yeah.
And it's a time consuming thing to see them like, you have to post an update. You have to comment on all this because you need that for the algorithm to feed itself. It just needs.
It never ends. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah. That's a good point. There's no barrier. It's just the Wild West. It's just, you know, I think obviously when you get to a certain point, it's probably not you as the artist even running the account to a certain extent.
To a degree, it is. I mean, Spencer has help, but Spencer runs his.
I think you can tell oftentimes, especially in the content,
mm-hmm.
how genuine they are. And like,
for sure.
Spencer does a really good job of, I've seen some of his videos where it's like the outtakes or just like how many times it took for him to make this one clip. And he's super, he's got character.
Oh, you know? He's really funny. Yeah. I mean, he's a very, very funny. He's probably one of the funniest artists I've ever worked for.
Yeah.
He is naturally funny, a clown, if you will.
Yeah.
So he has that, like, that helps him. He has that charisma.
But, yeah.
You know, it still takes time. And it's still, that's time he could be doing anything else. Writing songs, practicing anything he wanted to do, spending time with his family, friends. You know, I mean, it's a balance. And it's a tough balance for artists, I think, that really have to, especially when they have, like, label people, like, breathing down their necks, like, we need this. And a lot of times the label does stuff to make that easier. They send people to film, and they're going to edit it and all that stuff. But still.
Yeah.
Still time out of your life.
Yeah.
It's true.
Well, as a quick segue before we wrap up here, just in terms of talking about content and video, but photography, that's another passion of yours.
Yeah.
When did that begin, and how have you balanced that with drumming?
Well, it started because I, you know, everybody had a phone that has a camera now. And I was sort of like, I feel like I can figure this out. I don't know why. There's just something that I was like, I want to be able to make this happen. And it's
that mechanical engineering brain, right?
I guess. But there was something that I was always about it that I was always drawn to. And I just felt like I couldn't. The pictures never looked exactly like they needed to.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't put my finger on it. You know, it was that you're talented, or you're like, you have enough of the talent to get you close, but then you're like, I don't know what I'm missing. And looking up photography stuff is a pointless endeavor in terms of like information, because there's just all these rules and stuff. And I think that in photography school, if you do that, it's like, these are the rules. Here's examples of those. And you can be like, oh. And it gets programmed.
Yeah.
So I just started to try to intake more of it. But anyway, I took a personal trip. It's the most extravagant personal trip I've ever taken. And it was definitely still on a budget, but I went to Hong Kong.
Whoa.
Which I had been before. I've been very lucky to go on the road, like paid to be there. But I went for like 5 days or 6 days or something like that. And
when was this?
This was 2016 or 2017.
Okay.
I'd have to go back and look. It was like, but it just happened. I remember it was November mm-hmm. of the year that I went. And I took a bunch of photos and they all felt like close. And I was like, this is driving me crazy. Anyway, it was before the Europe thing happened with Cindy. That's when I went, like right around then. And I decided, this is all just sort of gestating around. You know, there's no solid ideas with any of it. And then someone I think was like, this is a good shot. It just needs this, this, and this done in an edit. And then I realized like how much, it's just like mixing your drums. They sound better when they've got a little bit of mix on them. Doesn't even need to be much, but
yeah,
it makes a huge difference.
Tweaks, yeah.
And it's no different in photography, you know? So I did some edits and I was like, whoa, these are fucking crazy. And I was kind of surprised. You know, actually it started, I'd say the place it started for me was I got an accidental amazing photograph. Didn't know what I was doing. I was actually trying to take a picture of a different thing. And I was at a temple in Taiwan, the first time I ever went abroad like that to Asia. And it was before the show. And I was just trying to take a picture of this crazy, I don't know, censer. Like they were just burning like an incense, but it was huge. It's not like the ones at like the Catholic Church that are like, you know, a softball. This was massive.
Wow, yeah.
And it was golden. The thing holding it was golden. And I was like, this is crazy. So I had it framed up. Someone said something. I turned back around and I just snap it with my phone. And a woman has stepped into the frame and she's got like an incense in her hand. And it's like perfect alignment. And I was like, oh. Yeah.
Art.
And that's sort of like that was the seed. And that, it took years. I mean, that was 4 or 5 years beforehand. And then it was just like a kind of a casual thing. So anyway, the Cindy thing happens and I'm trying to figure out some ways to like just make back any of the money. So I was like, okay, well, and I got a lot of compliments on the photos that I took in Hong Kong. So I was like, fine, why don't I'm going to print 5 of these, whatever. It was like 8 or something. And I'm going to number them and I'll sell them. They won't be expensive, but like whatever. And I sold all of them except for like 2.
Wow.
Which was cool. And so then I was like, oh, well, there was the part of like, I don't necessarily want to do this to make money, but then I was like, oh, okay, well, maybe I should buy a camera and not just use my phone. So I bought a camera. And when I would do the tech gig, there was a lot of off days. And I'd just be bored because I was also like, in some of this time, I was newly sober and I was just trying to like figure out bullshit. And I'd just walk around. I really was trying to be healthier. So I would just walk and I'd take my camera. And I'd just take a lot of photos and then I'd edit them, you know, like at night in a hotel room or whatever. And it was fun and it was just another thing to do. And I was probably pursuing it a little bit more seriously for a while. And I mean, a great example of a drummer who pivoted and like now it's kind of all he does is Sam Wiseman. He's a great drummer. And we used to toss gigs back and forth before the pandemic. And then in the pandemic, he like knuckled down. Mm-hmm. And he is an insanely good photographer now. He does a lot of portrait work and he does some food work because his wife's also a photographer and worked in food for a long time. So they do that. But like, man, he's doing great and he's making great shit. But I don't know. I've just sort of like hit a little bit of a wall recently and haven't felt, I don't know, as inspired to do it. I've also had less time. The travel thing, like if you're doing a bus or you fly and you have an off day, that's the prime thing. Country tours also can be pretty difficult because it's like if you go to a 6 Second Saloon in Indianapolis, there's nothing around that place.
Yeah.
At all. So especially nothing to photograph.
Yeah.
So you're sort of just like, okay. And so I don't know. I don't think I'm done, and I've been trying to do a little bit more of that again. Yeah. But I mean, I also got really into it because I was doing all the photos I did all the photos at the shop for a while. Or not all of them, but I did a lot of them to help, and I still do some of that every once in a while if we're in a real bind. But I mean, photos, just like everything, it takes a lot of time. It's just like editing music. It can be a time-consuming process. I mean, when you're doing more commercial shooting, like items and stuff, you do have a little bit more of a set. You could create a preset and then just tweak from there.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, when I'm like walking around DC and it was a cloudy day at the beginning of it, and then it opened up and now there's all this extra light. You can't just even for the day develop like a sort of starting point.
Yeah.
And I, for better or for worse, I usually edit everything from scratch. I don't have like a place I start.
Yeah.
In terms of things, I just sort of like start tweaking of what I think it needs. But
man, that's just so cool hearing that it was like a beautiful transition. Like it wasn't something that was forced on you. Like mm-hmm. it wasn't like you weren't in school for it. Just like you,
yeah.
it kind of found you at a really important time in your life.
Yeah, yeah.
And just back to Nelson's, I mean, you and Caleb, like killing it with content. I mean,
that's all Caleb.
You know,
I can't take any credit for that stuff. I mean, that guy's a monster.
The drum porn hashtag, I think.
Oh, yeah.
It's very fitting with the content you guys are putting out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he came in.
Some of those pictures.
I just now have three lenses. That dude came in with like five or six. He was a professional photographer.
Guns blazing,
Before that. I mean, he, and videographer. So he had a gimbal. I mean, this guy's a pro.
Yeah.
I'm just here. Knowing enough to be dangerous.
That's what it comes back to, knowing enough to be dangerous.
Yeah.
I'll write that down.
So that's sort of like...
That's the name of the podcast.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that that's I guess as like a parting thought, I think that I have definitely lived most of my life as like a jack of all trades, master of none situation. Because, I don't know, I mean, while I grew up outside of Athens, I mean, Athens is not a big town. It has a lot of musical history, but it's 200,000, 300,000 people with all the students and all that staff. If they go away, it's a really small town. And Atlanta's not far, but I mean, it's pretty, when you get outside of Athens, man, it gets rural fast.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I lived. And so, you know, you just had to figure out how to do stuff. Both to entertain yourself, but also like your parents would have to do, you'd have to fix stuff. You'd have to work. You'd have to help your dad change the oil in the car because there's like one mechanic in the town or whatever. And, you know, it's funny to say that now and then go back because the urban sprawl has hit that zone and now it's like full suburbia. But it was not, I mean, I graduated with like 220 kids for the entire county.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's small at the time. And so, you just sort of had to get good at a lot of things. And I mean, and going to school for one thing and not pursuing it professionally and completely, you know, taking a hard left will make you have to do the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, also playing in a small area before a major city, you have to take every gig, which informs your musicality, but
totally.
It means that you aren't like, you aren't the double bass god of, you know, Chicago, Illinois or something, which means you're going to have an incredibly specialized, amazing thing. I just had like a little bit of everything.
Yeah. I mean, as you said, there's pros and cons to that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It seems like just hearing your journey, you've taken all those changes
I took I saw an interview before I moved to Nashville with Rich Redman, and he said, never say no. And I never said no. And I regret saying yes a lot of times to some of these gigs.
Yeah. And we've talked about that a bunch. I mean, I don't think that's always good, just like blanket advice to always say yes.
No, great example.
But yeah, we know what he means by that.
Great singular example. I had played with an artist, done an opening slot, 30 minutes, tracks and SPDSX heavy, whole time. Then, and then they loved it. And I will be honest, I did a great job. They asked me to do a 90-minute set, and I did not, and they did not give me the SPDSX and the files in enough time.
Yeah.
And it was too much, music and too much like... The pad was laid out differently for every song because there were just so many different things that like my chart also had a pad diagram for every song and it was too much information. And the guy changed the set list on stage.
Oh my God.
And I melted down. It's the only gig I've ever like I absolutely could not recover.
Like what happened though? I mean,
I just like I killed the tracks on like the rest of the, like almost a third of the rest of the set after. And then we were about halfway done. I mean, I got let go the next day, which I absolutely should have. I was not prepared enough, and it sucked because there was a lot of really talented people on the other instruments that are really established, and that's what they think of me. And that's a great example of when not to say yes.
Yeah, no,
if you don't feel like you can do,
it helps to work with, I don't know this artist, but like that artist could have been giving you a better situation.
Right?
I mean, giving you more time, not changing the set. I mean,
absolutely.
Come on.
Like, absolutely. You shouldn't have to deal with. But that's part of,
you know,
it's part of being a professional.
Yeah.
Is you got to roll.
Exactly.
And like, if you can only do it in the perfect set of circumstances, then you aren't prepared. And that's what I learned from that lesson. My phone did die about a year ago, but I kept that was at the era where I was recording every single gig on my phone.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept that one and I would listen to it whenever I needed a reminding, which was
a humble reminder.
Those were not fun days to go back and listen to, because it was like really apparent.
Yeah. Wow.
But I think it's a really good thing to know your limit. That's what that all like boils down to.
Mm-hmm.
I've definitely said yes to some things that I shouldn't have.
Yeah.
No, and like winged it enough that it was fine, but you know, you may not get called back.
Yeah.
And it's not even, will that artist call you back? It's like, oh, that bass player is now a big producer. And he's going to be like, oh, that guy didn't do a great job on that one. So he's probably not going to call you.
That's really good advice. It's not just saying yes and then, okay, well.
Absolutely.
It's not just like you're making a spreadsheet of tallying up all the gigs you've said yes to. No, it's how you performed on those gigs.
Correct.
So saying yes means also say yes if you can actually perform it at a high level.
Yes. And it's tough.
Yeah.
Some artists are more demanding than others.
It's true.
In weird ways.
Mm-hmm.
So. Heck of a plan, man. Put off of a back row. Say, I don't really like your style. I said, loud, loud, let it go. You don't know my
favorite restaurant in Nashville to go to.
Oh, God, you asking the tough ones off the bat, dog. Okay, ones that come to my Deg Thai. On Nolensville Road.
We just had Neil Yagapin on. Was that Tim Miller? No, that was Neil.
It was Neil.
Yeah, it was Neil.
It's different, I would say, as a caveat, just so if you're not familiar with it, it does have a much smaller menu than most Thai restaurants, but it is one of the most consistent Thai restaurants in town. That's my complaint. It's not that there's not good Thai restaurants. It's that you can go and order the exact same thing, and it will be like a wildly different version of it.
Yeah, that's weird.
That's true. I have experienced that.
Yes. I mean, Smiling Elephant, they're guilty.
Yeah.
I mean, Thai Phuket, rest in peace, at least the one in town. I'm not going to drive all the way out to Rivergate. I'm just not. Sorry. Also, a lot of mine are going to be on the south side. Another good one is Osh, O-S-H. It's Uzbeki food.
Whoa.
Uzbekistan.
I've never even heard of that.
It's like a mixture of a little bit Greek, a little bit Russian, a little bit Turkish.
Wow. Okay. Cool.
I just ate there last night, actually.
Nice.
That place is really good. Are we doing what? Top five?
Give us one more.
Okay. Yeah. Redheaded Stranger is really good, although I will say I absolutely cannot stand how long it has started to take, even if there's no one in front of me. I have ordered and waited 45 minutes multiple times at this point, to the point where now it's like really a turnoff.
Yeah.
But man, do I love that fucking Crunchwrap, bro. Kill me.
I can go for a Crunchwrap right about now.
Yeah.
Okay. In the last year, favorite purchase under $100?
Drum-related or doesn't matter?
Doesn't matter. Drum-related is great, but I'll take any.
This is a good question. I can tell you.
A new hat for Frank.
Oh.
No, just kidding.
I mean, there have been some good hats. This hat, I would say, this hat is older than a year. Also, I didn't purchase it. Kylie Morgan bought this hat for me. She got all of us hats, airbrushed hats, at a festival we played in North Carolina. Favorite purchase in the past year the one that's made my life the easiest is probably one of the mic clips from Wilkinson Audio. The 3D printed, either fixed XY or fixed ORTF.
Oh, that's cool.
Or even one that will allow you to share like a 57 and a small diaphragm for a snare drum. They're all like under $20.
What's the name of this?
Wilkinson.
Right.
With an I, Wilkinson. You do have to pay shipping from Canada, which is the drag. But they're cheap. Under $20, I think. Under $25, I think, for almost everything on their website. They also have some like really cool stuff, like a little clip that you can clip on a 57 that'll make it omni if you want to get weird.
Very cool. I'll check that out.
So that's probably the one I could.
All right.
That's changed my life the most.
Under $100.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. I'll close out with, just to bring it back to drums a little bit here. Give us like your top three or just three drummers that come to mind, either current guys that you're listening to or just, older generational influences.
I think my guys still to this day is still Matt Chamberlain, still my number one.
Yeah.
Been very lucky to get to hang out with him. And, but I mean, every time I'd go, I just feel like he pulls some like weirdo stuff out. Not even necessarily tonal, which he does tonally, but he does from a timbre standpoint, but just some just really cool parts that are always a little off kilter. Keltner's a big guy. I love Keltner, especially the lesser known stuff. I mean, all the big things are cool and everything, but like his work with Bill Frisell, I'm really into an Anthony Wilson. That's a big one. And then let's go with a new guy.
Yeah.
Man, Yousef Dayes.
Oh man,
that guy.
Not familiar.
He is an absolute animal. But the thing is it's so musical.
He's just oozing with groove.
Yeah,
dude.
But has a thumbprint, which is the other thing I've really come to appreciate with guys who can shred. Lewis Cole's another great example of someone who has like such a thumbprint that can shred. But like Yousef pretty much exclusively plays with his two rack toms with no bottom head. But the floor tom has a bottom head. So it's like creates, it's very old school in that way and plays like a really big 24-inch Istanbul that's super dark as a ride, but then 13-inch hi-hats. So it's like the
unique setup, yeah.
It's a very polarized sound. It's really cool.
But I got into him from his record he did with Tom Misch, which
is a sick record.
Oh, man, it's got Freddie. There's a song that's got Freddie Gibbs on it that's just a banger. Banger Central. That was a big pandemic. Listen, I probably burned that record alive.
I need to go listen to that again. I was listening to it in a bunch, and it's been a while. But he's one of those dudes that every time I think about him, I'm like, that dude, what a motherfucker.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And he's got a newer like trio that he does a lot of stuff with that's Pino's son playing bass and Charlie Stacy on keys. And, man, that is some nasty jams. In the best way. I really like that. That's probably the new guy that I am the heaviest into. That's never going to be a skip if one of his videos come up.
Yeah, that was three great answers there.
And finally, where do you want people to find you?
Hopefully at one of the restaurants that I named earlier. But I'm on all the... I'm not on Twitter. I got out of Twitter a long time ago because I... was a bad boy and said a lot of mean
did
things.
You upset Elon?
No, this is well before that, actually.
Yeah.
I was an asshole on there one time, and it ended up getting back to the person, and it was a friend of a friend, and I was really general, but it was had enough identifying information.
Enough implications, yeah.
And I was like, you know what? That just needed to stay in my brain. Never needed to leave.
That's that. You know what? I'm going to go out and go ahead and say this to a lot of y'all. A lot of things y'all be saying on Twitter or X, and now I guess it's called. I don't have it. I haven't had it, so I don't know.
Yeah,
just keep it in your brain.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have a Threads thing.
Yeah.
You still use Facebook? I'm just Lemuel Hayes on there. I'm that same thing. I think on YouTube. I don't know. I don't ever really post to either of those.
What's your Instagram handles?
I'm Lemuel.wave. Lemuel is Lemuel, like Samuel, but with an L-E. It's biblical.
Nice.
It's also Max Roach's middle name.
I didn't realize that.
Maxwell Lemuel Roach.
Did not know that.
Threads, it's also Lemuel.wave because it's all the same thing. I don't know. I think I'm on TikTok. I think it's also Lemuel.wave.
And then .jpg.
Yeah. If you want the photos only, if that's what you're really here for, you sat through all the drum and music talk just for the photo stuff. Yeah, Lemuel.jpg. My website is just my name, LemuelHayes.com, because there's like none of those except my dad. And it's got my photos on there. There's also a link to if you want to buy a print. There's some photos, or if there's one, there's my Pixie Set page, which is like automated. They just print the file on whatever size you want. But if you want like a real fancy boy one, I use a local place here called Chromatics, which if you ever want like a really, really nice fine art print, that's the place to go. They're super nice. They're on Murfreesboro Pike.
Cool.
And long time Nashville business.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Awesome. Mobile. We'll put those plugs into the show notes.
Plugs.
And dude, it's so good to learn your journey.
Thank you.
Been through a lot of, you know, changes and it's inspiring hearing how you've recovered through a lot of the physical and mental health stuff that you were dealing with.
Yeah.
But awesome, man. Well, looking forward to talking to you more into the new year.
I'm around.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll go visit him at Nelson's. We'll see you there.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Nashville Drummers Podcast.
If you've enjoyed these podcasts, please consider supporting us on Patreon. For $5 a month, you can help support this dream and keep the ball rolling for us. Believe it or not, it's not free or even necessarily cheap for us to make this thing go. To sign up, go to patreon.com/Nashville Drummers Podcast or click the link in our Instagram bio. All of your help is greatly appreciated.
Check out our new website, NashvilleDrummersPodcast.com. And if you're not already following us on Instagram, you can follow us at Nashville Drummers Podcast.
This episode was recorded at Diamond Sound Studios, located in Nashville, Tennessee.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.